And then when we did a little bit deeper genomic analysis, we saw that sometime the serotype that we isolate from this feed mill were clustering in the same tree, in the same cluster of human and clinical pathogen, making their genetic relatedness very short. And so that means they are related.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Kemin invites you to optimize animal feed quality and safety with our portfolio of solutions. Learn more at kemin.com/AG. Evonik, we are sciencing the global food challenge.
Welcome to the Feed Science Podcast. My name is Adam Farinals, coming to you from the Animal Food Manufacturing Program here at North Carolina State University in the Prestige Department of Poultry Science, and on behalf of Wisenetics. Our guest today is Valentina Trinetta. Valentina is an associate professor in food safety and microbiology at Kansas State University. Valentina, how are you doing today?
Good. Thank you for calling me in and participating to this interview.
Yeah, we're very, very glad to have you. As we would usually do with any of our guests on the podcast, the first thing we'd really like you to do is introduce yourself to the audience. Let us know kind of how you got to be doing what you're doing today, and then we'll follow that up with what exactly that is that you do there at the university.
Yes. So again, hi, everybody. I am Valentina Trinetta. I'm an associate professor in food safety and microbiology at Kansas State University. I am working with trying to understand how foodborne pathogens enter in the food supply chain. And I like to use the term from feed to fork. I use the term feed because one of my first study when I started this job was to evaluate the presence and incidence of Salmonella and Escherichia coli in a feed mill facility around the United States. We repeated this study for a couple of years, and we got some interesting results. My research doesn't focus only on feed. I like to study environment, not only for feed production, but also for food production. And as I tell always to my student, bacteria are intelligent, and so they like to live together. And so in the last couple of years, my focus has been in studying microbial community, what we call biofilm. And this is a topic that I can tell you is going to come back for the pet food industry, for the swine industry, because biofilm form in area where the operator, the employer that clean and sanitize cannot reach very well. And that's where the problem starts. So this is from feed to fork.
You mentioned when you did some of your original first work there, when you came to the university, you were focusing on looking for pathogens in animal food, in this case, feed mill facilities. And you said you found some interesting things. What are some of the interesting things that you would say that you found?
First of all, like in seasonality for outbreak for human pathogen, we observe the same seasonality for the presence of pathogen in this feed facility when warm weather we're allowing to pathogen to grow and replicate better than in colder months. Sometimes we find some overlap with some serotype that are pathogenic and dangerous for human that were present in this feed facility. We didn't want it to go, our focus was more for human health than for animal health, because the overall goal was to try to understand if this feed mill could represent a entry route for this pathogen into the human food supply chain. We also found a lot of bacillus, a lot of pseudomonas, a lot of microorganisms that we consider spoilers that a lot of time have a protective function towards this foodborne pathogen. So that was interesting. And then when we did a little bit deeper genomic analysis, we saw that sometime the serotype that we isolate from this feed mill were clustering in the same tree, in the same cluster of human and clinical pathogen, making their genetic relatedness very short. And so that means they are related.
That is very interesting. I guess kind of following along that line of you were looking at the human pathogens and pathogens of concern, that serotypes that would be injurious to human health and that sort of thing. We know that that's a major concern, for example, on the pet food side, because that animal food goes into the home. It's handled by all kinds of people, some of whom might be children or elderly or immunocompromised. And because they're actually handling that and maybe not always doing the best job of washing their hands or washing the countertop where they prepared their dog food that day or whatever, that's a potential pathway. From your experience, what is the difference between that when we're going into that animal food that goes into the home versus our the things that we are interested in looking at for feed that doesn't, for feed that is being directly consumed by a food producing animal? So meat, milk, and eggs coming out of the poultry, dairy, beef and swine industries primarily.
Yeah.
How do we need to look at those things the same? How do we need to look at them differently from an animal food manufacturer based on what the hazards or potential concerns or pathways look like?
Thank you for the controversial question. The risks are different. I kind of agree with you that the risks are different. I see from a food safety consumer point of view, the pet food that enter in your house being more risky if potentially as a foodborne pathogen. And that's another work that I'm doing with the Pet Food Alliance in trying to understand if rendering fat that sometimes coat those pet food can be a carrier of foodborne pathogen. And we demonstrate that while the rendering industry with their thermal process does an outstanding job in making the foods, the product safe when leaves the facility, is probably the transportation that might be a point of concern, because those trucks go around and stay on the road and have a lot of fluctuation with temperature. And even without the problem of the temperature, between loads are clean and sanitized. And even if a couple of droplets of water stain that truck, can be a reservoir, for example, for Salmonella. We have studies that show that while it doesn't grow, it can persist.
Okay.
So the correct handling of pet food in household, I think, is more important for human health because pose a higher risk. Now, while I kind of agree that the risk of having a foodborne pathogen for human health in feed mill doesn't pose as much risk as it in the pet food industry, I do think that we overall underestimated the risk, because at this point, it seems like nobody really cares. But for me, it's an underestimation of the potential risk. And I'm doing an example of Listeria. Listeria can, even one cell of Listeria can make a person sick. And so are we waiting for that moment? And unfortunately, the food safety history kind of teach us that we get action after big event happen. So what we were trying to do with that initial study with the feed mill processing facility is like, maybe there is a lot of space between having a contaminated feed, passing to the animal, and repassing through processing and fabrication of meat, but at least be aware and maybe start cleaning and sanitation also in your facility, because the risk is there.
I'm not being anything close to microbiologist. I would assume that to some extent, some of the reason that risk is lower is because while there might be some things present in the animal food, and we'll stick with to human health, while there might be some things present in the animal food that are injurious to human health, it's possible anyway. I will acknowledge it's possible. They're not necessarily injurious to the animal, and the animal gets to act as a filter of those things for us. Is that a fair thing to say? I mean, there's obviously a lot of things that the animals, various different animals, can eat, will eat, want to eat for that matter, that we don't as humans. And so that's one of the kind of the benefits of the system, is that we can take something and not worry as much about its direct impact as if I were to go out into the ingredient bin in the feed mill and start trying to consume something in there, that the animal in some cases purifies some of that into the protein that I'm going to consume. Is that a fair way to look at that?
I would say yes, because when, I don't know if the exact terminology to use, mm-hmm. what really the animal is doing, but I can tell you that we did a subsequent study where we inoculate feed, water, and air, and we give it. So we did a gavage to this piglet, and we mm-hmm. keep them for 10 days with this type of regimen. So one group have contaminated water, the other group have contaminated feed, and the third group we inhalate with contaminated aerosol. Okay. Our hope was that we could see when we sacrifice the animal, bacteria in the muscle.
Okay.
And so that would prove that right. the animal doesn't do anything to the pathogen. Instead, I can tell you that the accumulation of pathogen was mainly in the gastrointestinal tract and in lymph node. And so mm-hmm. that make me conclude that if a pathogen is there and we get it in the consumer house, is because during processing and fabrication, mm-hmm. There was a cross-contamination. Because we did on 10 piglets that we analyzed, there was none that had any pathogen in the muscle.
But I think it's important to point out, because I think this goes back to your statement there of maybe it's not in the meat, and I'm going to try to say this in a way that doesn't get my feed industry people upset with me. It's not in the meat, and therefore, okay, we're not as concerned about it being in what you consume, assuming that it was processed well, that it was packaged properly, that everybody washed their hands, and you know, after they handled the raw meat, all these other kinds of things. So yes, the animal can act in a way that it's not, per your research, showing up in the muscle and that sort of thing. But that doesn't mean that you weren't able to say, but there was a pathogen that was present in the feed or the water that ended up over here in the animal. It ended up in the animal, just not in the part you consumed, which means that there is a pathway for risk that is worth considering.
Yes, and that was another part of our study. We were trying to survey this facility and say, do you at least have a small lab or on site, or do you ever consider send out your entry ingredient or end product, or do you want to do some environmental swabbing, but the interest is not there yet. Mm-hmm. And it's depending also on how big this facility are, if they are vertically integrated or not. And so those are all parameters that needs to be considered.
Excellent points. Once again, my guest today is Valentina Trinetta. Valentina is an associate professor in food safety and microbiology at Kansas State University. Yeah, I'm sitting here thinking about that in my head and thinking, well, on the one hand, I want to be the feed milling guy. I'm like, see, processing plant's problem. Got to deal with that. But they already get all the money anyway, and we don't want them to get all the money. We want the feed mills to get some money. So that might not be a good argument to make. But going back a little bit, we can go back into the mill. Obviously, when you went through and you were looking for these potential pathogens of concern, you were looking across the entire processing flow of the feed mill. Were there specific spots where, okay, this is where most of it is? Did it basically, if it was at the beginning, it made it to the end? Were there parts where it accumulated, or parts where, you know, it's interesting, we didn't find anything in this area? Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yes. So we did visit both feed mill that were doing pelleting mill and mesh mill feed, and we didn't really observe any difference between the two way of producing feed. And that was interesting because we were thinking, since the pelleting mill as the temperature kill step, to have a significant difference, but that was not the case for our study. I can tell you in general that in the receiving, when the truck come and leave the ingredient, is the highest point of contamination. There is a decrease when you start entering in the facility and you do the pelleting, so the killing step is effective around that manufacturing area. Was very rare to find any positive sample. Control room and the broom and the shoes were positive. That means mm-hmm. that probably a way to control entering and exiting of the truck driver might be a good point. And that has been proved true also for viruses. So
sure.
It's true also for bacteria. This uncontrolled entry can totally bring pathogen from farm, from external environment. So that was a hot point to make them understand. And then the final bean boot, where the ingredient, where the final feed is waiting for the truck, right?
Mm-hmm.
That
mm-hmm.
was super contaminated.
Huh, that's interesting.
When we studied the process, we thought that was contaminated because it's rarely clean, because it's very difficult mm-hmm. to reach. And so depending on the time that the final product stay in that bin, has a higher risk to get recontaminated, even if it was clean, and then go directly to the truck. So that was an interesting point. But we think it's because it's very cumbersome to get clean as compared to the floor and the manufacturing process.
It's interesting because when you kind of start putting all of these things together that you're talking about, and I would say that I tend to agree with you. There's a gray area somewhere for especially the like livestock feed mills to exist in. Okay, you may not need to be a, you know, commercial human food facility. You may not even need to be a pet food facility. We also may not want to just say, we've not really had any problems with, you know, salmonella or E. coli or anything else impacting the animals that we know of. Obviously, you know, maybe there could be subclinical things that we otherwise wouldn't pick up. And therefore, we should not have to do anything. And the answer is probably somewhere more in the middle of maybe it's not that you don't need to do anything. You just might not have to go over here to this incredibly high level of control because you do have some advantages in what it is you are making and what it is you are feeding. And some of it, based on what you just said, shoes and control room and probably cabs of trucks and various other places has to do with entry exit, might have to do with, you know, cleaning in different ways, might have to do with cleaning more often or more completely. Not necessarily everyone needs to go out and completely redesign a whole new facility in order to, you know, make this not an issue. There are probably tools that we have at our disposal. And so I think as we're coming into the end of our half hour here, that would be my next question is, has any of your research gone into, you know, kind of what are the effective types of cleaning for this? Obviously, if we have the ability to wash down with really hot water and sanitization chemicals and everything else, that's great. But in most like livestock feed mills, that's not an answer. So were you able to discern anywhere in any of the research you've done, you know, different kinds of mills and or different things you've done in a laboratory setting, this kind of cleaning works pretty well versus that kind of cleaning or no cleaning does not?
Thank you for the question. That's something that we are exploring now.
Okay.
Before starting my position at Kansas State University, I was working for a chemical company. And so I'm pretty familiar with chemical sanitation and disinfection. Pet food facility, feed mill facility are what we consider dry facility. And so, let's say, not many people want water in those kind of facilities. You are just going to increase the ability of Salmonella or E. coli to spread everywhere. And so that's something that I am starting to investigate now. For the transportation industry,
okay,
that kind of like the feed mill facility, if they can avoid water because of the harsh temperature, they will be more happy. And so I have experience with technologies such as chlorine dioxide gas. And so that's one of the possibility that I'm proposing them. I have been reading interesting thing on supercritical CO2, that is like dry ice. Mm-hmm. And that will be the same principle of chlorine dioxide, but probably have a different time and different way to be applied. The only thing that I see as a maybe can be an issue is that chlorine dioxide gas has the ability to penetrate well everywhere, but the facility needs to be without employee and needs to be completely sealed. So there are some industry, I can tell you, like cereal facility or pet peanut butter facility that will close when they start seeing through environmental swabbing, this kind of problem, they will stop production for 2 days. They will have all employee out of the facility and then close the facility, seal it, and gas it. I don't know how the feed mill facility or the transportation industry will respond on that. And so what I'm trying to do is trying to evaluate relatively short amount of time so that might be easier for them.
Gotcha. No, I think a lot of us would very, very much like it if our feed mills were that kind of sealed that we could do something like that. Most of them are not.
Most
of them we've got holes and things somewhere. And I suppose if you've got, you know, a little bit of leakage and your feed mill happens to be in a, you know, downtown populated type area, which some of our older facilities still are, chlorine dioxide gas, probably not something your neighbors are real happy about you pumping in. I can just imagine. But no, it's interesting. And I think it's an interesting point of, you know, I there might be things like that that are coming that people need to be aware of, gassing things, heating things, running flushes through with high concentrations of, you know, some sort of a chemical additive that would help with some of these things.
I think there are tools that other industry use that could be easily translate and adapt to the feed mill facility.
I agree.
It's time for our famous three.
Well, it's been a great conversation. As we close out, follow up with a few questions that we like to ask all of our guests. The first is, in your specific area, so on these things related to animal food and food animal safety, and like you said, all the way from feed to fork, if people want to learn more about this, what would you say are some good resources for people to go learn more that are, you know, good reputable places to try to get some information on the topic?
Yeah, so there is there's been recently established a PDG, so a professional development group within the IIFP Association, that is the International Food and Protection Association, and so that's a PDG for animal and pet food industry, and so that's a lot of where I'm going and I'm looking for. There they are available online, and I think the annual meeting is in July, but they do also organize a seminar and exchange of information throughout the year. Pet Food Alliance has been a great source of information for me as well. They have been doing also some seminar through the year that I follow, and they have good information.
Good. Yeah, those sound like two excellent sources. I'm more familiar with the Pet Food Alliance than the former, but they both sound quite good. Okay, these last two are the ones that are usually maybe a little more fun. A resource that you've used kind of in your career you think that's helped you? We've had people talk about books or trade associations or groups they've been a part of, all kinds of different things that people have come up with that have really benefited them as they've kind of grown in their career. That's not just content for being a subject matter expert, but more about kind of growing as a professional. Any thoughts on that one?
I think the professional association that helped me the most to grow as a person, as a scientist, is Institute of Food Technology. And that's where, because I think that's where I network the most. And so I talk, I listen, I learn, and then I grow. And so that's kind of a suggestion that I give to everybody. Wherever you see fit, just talk and network with people.
I think that's a great suggestion. I think many times when we think about the associations that we join, that we're a part of, I think this is true in both academia and in the folks in the industry. And you go and you think about, okay, I need to go see this talk, I need to go learn this, I need to whatever, but there's just so much value in just getting to know the different people and hear their experiences, let them hear yours, and watch those ideas flow. And then you you find mentors that way, and you find mentees that way. And I think that's really, really valuable. So I like that answer a lot. Last question then, and it kind of dovetails into that, is, for those that are listening, and we hope that some of our audience, we know that some of our audience is younger professionals that are growing in their career. And everybody that we are lucky enough to have join us on the podcast here is somebody who has made a name for themselves somewhere in this industry and in this topic. So what are the things that you've seen in others that you have tried to emulate in your career that are qualities or characteristics of how they have gone about handling their business and have made them successful?
Maybe very simple, but having a smile and being optimistic, even if the situation is not the perfect one. But I think that a lot of time, I can see it in working situation, experiment, dealing with problem. If look at the positive aspect that should be in every situation. And so I had one of my mentor, and one time, he's always positive. And one time they ask him, but you are, you are always with the smile. It's like, that's how I would like people see me. And that's the feeling that I want to show to other. That doesn't mean that that when I come home, I don't have my 5 minutes meltdown, but that's how I want to communicate with people. And so I'm trying to do the same. It's good. If you energize and if you are positive, positiveness comes back to you.
That's a great suggestion. I think I could be wrong. We've done a number of these and other hosts have done them as well. So maybe somebody else has said something like that, but we hear a lot of, hard work and efficiency and listening to people and all those kinds of things, which are also all on their own. Excellent. For me, as far as I can remember, that's the first time someone's said, have a smile on your face, be positive. And you know what? That's a really, really good point of, if you want people to want to work with you, then they're going to have to want to be around you. And if for that, they're going to want to feel good when they are working with you and being around you. That's a good one. I will try to do that more myself. That's a lesson I could learn too. Well, Valentina, I've very much appreciated our conversation. It's been great. I appreciate your time with us.
Thank you again for getting me talk.
Yeah, you bet. Our guest today has been Valentina Trinetta. She's an associate professor in food safety and microbiology at Kansas State University. Once again, I'm Adam Fahrenholz from North Carolina State University, and on behalf of Wisenetics, please have a good rest of your day wherever you are listening to this, and we will talk to you next time.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without the time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.